This episode is part two of the LARP Roundtable. If you haven't heard part one already, be sure to go back and download and listen to episode 173 first. It's Friday, December 18th, 2009, and you're listening to episode 174 of Fear the Booth, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 31 minutes. But this leads into a question of mine, which is, I was wondering, do you guys ever find that a person's real skills can become game-breaking? And let me give you an example.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Chad and I have had a long-standing debate about whether social skills should be rolled or role-played. And I believe they should be rolled because you may be more or less charismatic than your character is. But now let's take that to a LARP to the nth degree. I may be more or less sneaky than my thief is. I may be able, as an example, when I was growing up, I learned how to do a handful of magic tricks. I can do a little bit of sleight of hand. And so there may be things I may be able to palm or steal as a human being, and my character should not be able to do that. And I'm curious how you guys draw the line of not adding abilities of, okay, this ball represents a lightning bolt that you can't really throw, to going the other direction of saying, you're not allowed to bring these real skills into the game.
Well, for starters, the rule systems that are out there are a bit of an equalizer, and they allow players who have been playing for longer to get a bit of an edge on those that have not. But if you can throw a baseball really well, then you can whang somebody on the head with a spell packet, no problem. And it's the same thing with a social game. Talking about Vampire, if you put, say, all your points into your physical and your intellectual areas, and you sort of dump stat your social, it's not tough to be a bit of a weasel and play a very suave social character, despite the fact that your stats say otherwise. I think it's pretty much up to you on your honor to play as your character should play.
For the more physical part, is the people who tend to be better sword fighters are sword fighters. For the people who are better archers, they're archers within this organization. And for the people who can't do either, they typically play the spellcasters, or the healers, or the wizards, or the druids. I laughed when you said giving it an advantage, because I was probably going to refrain from saying this, but one of the reasons why I don't play in Nero, besides for financial issues, is I like how it's a combo between role-playing and sword fighting, but I was a lot better of a sword fighter than anybody else there, where it wasn't a challenge, so I couldn't be a PC.
That's probably based on what you'd already done in the past too. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's definitely a mentality on certain skills where you can be on average with the people that you're playing with, but they are so much better than the next group that you go from being a small fish in a big pond to being a big fish in a small pond.
I'd been sword fighting for the last 10 years, and going to them, it's don't really want to verbally inflate myself, but I couldn't take it. I did about one weekend as a PC, and that's one of the reasons why I'll end PC, is making the PCs a little bit more challenged.
I've got a similar story here. I've been doing this for a good many years now, and I also have some training with the real steel stuff. So at any given event, I may not have any skills on paper regarding sword fighting, but I can beat most people on the field. But there's also parts of the game, depending on the system, which take place in between the actual events, in which case your physical skills have absolutely no bearing on anything. It's just what's on your character sheet. So there is a bit of an equalizer in that sense.
How do you know what's on other people's character sheet? I mean, if you're going up to someone and they have on their sheet that they're much, much better sword fighting than you, and you want to throw that to them for story reasons, how do you know that? How do you know what they have stat-wise?
But there's a level of abstraction. It doesn't tell them that they are a better sword fighter than you. What it tells them is that they have the ability to do these tricks, which they can then layer on top of how good a sword fighter they are.
Can you give me an example? Like, what do you mean by a trick?
For example, if you're fighting and you strike someone with a sword, in most systems, you do a single point of damage. And people wearing armor would take that damage off their armor rather than off themselves. Now, you can have special tricks which allow them to bypass your armor so that one point of damage goes straight onto you rather than onto the armor. Or maybe they can do 2 points of damage. Or maybe they can do 2 points of damage that go straight through your armor. So these are their tricks. But how good a swordsman they are You know, that's entirely dependent on how good a swordsman that player is.
You know, as we talk about LARPs, James, you had mentioned to me previously that one of the things you like to do is really create spectacle, that you like to, and probably going back to your theater background, you really like to have the right scenery, to rent the right location. You said at times you even cook the right kinds of food. You guys have also talked about gaming as a service, where you pay a fee which goes into all of the location, the props, the costumes and such. But it seems like any way we cut it, that's a really big part of this hobby that doesn't exist in most tabletop role-playing games, is in addition to having some kind of rule system or story or whatever you need to conduct the game, you also need all of these objects that have to be brought in, that have to be built or purchased. And I'm curious how that affects the hobby overall.
And I'm curious if there's a disparity between the people that have more money to do some of this and others, if certain people are looked down on because they don't have as good of a whatever.
People don't get looked down upon if they don't have great equipment. As long as they make an effort, at least that's been my experience. And certainly in the SCA, it's amazing, even though you may not have a great income, a lot of people, if they're focused in the SCA, have really great garb. But they sort of wear their riches on their belt, as it were.
There's ever areas where you're going to have to save their money up for the SCA. One of the big turnoffs for me, you have to pay, you know, the $100, $150 for a helmet because it's such heavy weapons and they hit so hard. They have rules where you're required to wear a gorget to protect your neck, a helmet to protect your skull, because you can seriously get hurt. And some of that, unless you have the tools to make it, can be very expensive. I mean, that is the big reason why I moved over to foam LARPs, because besides for like Nero, which charges about $15 a week, it's completely free. I mean, you get out what you put into it, though.
I'd like to say that there's no, you know, no one looking down on anybody else, but unfortunately, there is always some of that. But ultimately, you know, like the other said, if you put in the effort, most people are going to, you know, just appreciate the fact that you put in the effort, and they'll look at that as good enough. I mean, I'm involved in running some LARPs, and I can tell you right now that, yeah, some of it costs a lot of money to do. You've got to buy equipment. If you've got a crew of 30 people, you need to beg, borrow, or steal enough weapons for them to play multiple roles. Fortunately, a lot of that can be borrowed, and a lot of these people are willing to bring some of their own gear. But then there's also set dressing, which, depending on your budget, can be done very cheaply or can be done for extravagant amounts of money, you know, some places do. And it's all about payoff. You know, so you've got to balance the expenditure with what you're getting back from it. If something is cool enough, you're going to look at the 200 quid or however many dollars you've spent on building this one set piece, location, or what have you. And you're going to go, yeah, that was really expensive. I'd rather not do that again.
I would assume after you've done it once, you try to find as many ways to reuse it as possible.
Yeah, fiscally, the smart thing would be to do so. But there's a lot to be said for lending it to other groups, because then it's something new for them. And, you know, what comes around goes around, and people lend you things which cost them a lot of money or time or what have you, and they look fantastic. They've already used them. It wasn't new in their setting, but it's new in yours.
Nathaniel, since you're in the UK, I have to ask the dumb American question. Have you ever LARPed in a castle?
Have I ever LARPed in a castle? I haven't. Well, I don't know if you really call it a castle. It's a fortress. Some old Napoleonic era fortresses.
That's close enough for me.
I don't know if they still run games in them, but people certainly have. I mean, I've done them in manor houses, but no castles for me, I'm afraid.
So that's kind of something I was wondering about. We've been talking about all these big scheduled events. Are there just LARPs that happen in people's basements? Just, I have a group of 5 to 6 people. We want to meet once a week, just like a regular role-playing group would. We, you know, we don't want to wait for this big event. Are there just basement LARPs?
There are people that sort of split off from a larger LARP and form coteries and play, maybe it's like one narrator and say half a dozen people. But I think part of the appeal for LARP is that you get to interact with a greater number of people. You don't get quite the same experience, I think, with just 6.
It does seem like, though, in general, if you're looking to get into this, probably it's easier to start with a modern LARP because of the fact that the set pieces, the props, the costumes are all things that you probably own or have access to. This is not something you have to go out and build. I mean, I could walk into a bar down the street in character in a modern LARP, unless I say something really outlandish, nobody would even recognize that I'm in character. Whereas if you want to do something that's set in the Middle Ages or the far future, that you have to either be really imaginative, really forgiving, or really wealthy, one of the three.
You can make yourself look like from the Middle Ages or from the far future for a surprisingly small amount of money.
Well, maybe so, but I can find a house far cheaper than I can find a spaceship set, or find a castle, or find a...
And, you know, this isn't the place for it, but at some point, I'd love to hear some of those tips for making yourself look like you're from the Middle Ages cheaper, because I enjoy Renaissance festivals, and I admit that, you know, I've heard the term garbled. That's when you go in partial garb. So, like, I go with my boots and black khakis, but I have a shirt that's garb, and I have a robe.
And a cell phone.
And a cell phone.
It's not very hard. You just need to have a sewing machine and know a few little tricks to finding cheap fabric. Walmart's always a good resource for any LARP endeavor, but not many people think of like thrift stores. Like, get a large bed sheet and you can cut that up and you can make a lot of garb-related accessories out of that.
Oh, and don't forget that you're not required to use those expensive authentic materials. Modern fabrics and, you know, and machine sewing. It's a fantastic way of doing it on the cheap.
You know, it absolutely amazes me how cheap some of those clothes were at the time and how much you have to pay to look like a peasant now if you're actually buying this stuff.
Well, sure. It's the same reason ripped up jeans are more expensive than ones that aren't.
Yeah, but Michael's right. If you know a few tricks, you can take that cheap fabric and make yourself look like a peasant for a peasant's salary. I mean, there's tons of information on the net on basic costuming, and it's a great place to start.
And you'd be surprised at what you can do with some ordinary cotton t-shirts.
Like, currently I'm working on kind of a colonial period formal suit, similar to something like what George Washington would have worn. And I've got all the materials for it. It cost me about $10. It's not very much at all.
Okay, so Dan, I have to go back to, I've worn fangs, I've been seen in fangs. I've gone to Renaissance fairs quite a bit, I've had such a huge kick out of this. It seems logical that there's some sort of fit here, but no one's ever approached me. How do you guys get the people into it? I mean, we talked about how it's not something where you proselytize as much. There is some resistance there, but if we are interested, where do we start?
Well, I could say get online. Ask some people. You just found three people who can probably hook you up with some groups. I know there's a chapter of my organization in St. Louis, but how I got into it was an SCA flyer at a bookstore. The easiest thing is just looking like St. Louis LARP, St. Louis live action combat, medieval combat sport, and just, you know, whatever variation you can think of, you can do it. In about 10 minutes, I can find every LARP group in Arizona just based on that.
That would make me a bit nervous, though, because you can kind of do the same with a lot of role-playing groups, organizations. But how do you look at them and figure out what's a good group?
You know, the only starting point I was able to come up with thinking about this topic prior to the show was to contemplate the fan base. For example, and once again, I realize not everyone's the same, but if you go into a Camarilla-sponsored vampire LARP, you're probably going to encounter a certain type of person, and maybe that's your thing, maybe that's not. Here in St. Louis, we saw a huge culture clash, which got stupidly too real, between the vampire LARPers and the werewolf LARPers. And we had a group of vampire LARPers basically move in and just by sheer number take over a local coffee shop. And this ended when the werewolf LARPers came in, and because they were bigger, more strapping, more boisterous individuals, they ran the vampire LARPers out. And the
So Pat would have been like a vampire, Chad would have been like a werewolf. And he comes with enough hair to do it.
Yeah. And, but, you know, the end result of this, well, below the neck, he still does. But the end result of this, though, was I was commenting to somebody that I was actually almost glad it happened because I was part of neither group. But the werewolf people were much more outgoing, much more sociable. They were a lot less cliquish and predatory than the vampire people were. You could walk in and kick back a beer with the werewolf LARPers. And so I would hate to reduce this to stereotypes, but it does, at least to me, seem like there would be some advantage in looking at the fan base that a particular game tends to attract as part of your selection process.
That's absolutely true. I mean, if you break it down, a lot of the people playing Vampyr, just to use your example, they're people who really wish that they could be, for at least these couple of hours, a weekend or what have you, they really wish that they could be some badass predator of the night who basically preys on the weak and innocent. Because for whatever reason, it might be that they just think that it's cool thematically, and God knows, I've known quite a few people who are into it for that. Or, unfortunately, there's also those who are there because they are the exact opposite. They're not badass. They're not predatory. They don't have these alluring social skills. And, you know, you get those sorts of people attracted to the game. So you do have to look at the fan base. You've also got to think about whether or not these are the sort of people that you really want to be spending this allocated chunk of time with. Because if you don't like them, you don't have fun. Unless, of course, your idea of fun is messing with them.
Getting into the hobby, the first step is the biggest. My advice to anybody is just, if you know there's a Vampyr LARP going on at a Denny's, and you know what time they meet, just based on the website.
Call the police.
Yeah, get your werewolf people together. No, just go in, order dinner, and observe how they act. Because everybody will have that little pitch, because they are the socially awkward nerds just as much as you might be.
Right.
So I shouldn't show up with a cross and walk over to their table and, you know, be gone, foul beasts.
They'll probably love you and ask you to join.
No, just watch and, you know, see what happens. Or if you're at this sword fighting thing like what I do, wait for a game to start and then watch from the side so you can actually see what it's about. It's not going to kill you to ask. It's just my advice to the people who are interested.
Do any of you think that things like Renaissance fairs are kind of a, I don't want to use the phrase gateway drug, but a gateway drug into this? Gives people a chance to actually go out and test the waters of dressing up, see what it's like to be around people that are acting in character and things like that.
Well, you know, maybe not just Ren fairs, but some other things like that that I came up with. Murder mystery dinners.
Yeah.
Or like cosplays.
Cosplay. Games like Are You a Werewolf? It's a card. Well, it's not really a card game, but for anyone familiar with it, it's basically a live-action roleplay where you deal out a hand that tells you what role you are. You're a villager, you're a seer, or you're a werewolf. And it's a relatively simple LARP, but nonetheless, what ensues is a purely socially driven event. There's no dice rolling, there's no other mechanic to it. I was talking to James last night about alternate reality games. For anyone's not familiar with an ARG, it would be something like, it's kind of like the game doesn't exactly stop. And I don't mean that, once again, some crazy Blackleaf kind of way. But during the week, you might get an email from a character that it's addressed to your character and tells you a little bit. Or there might be a message on your answer machine when you come home, or a letter slipped in with your mail or something like
that.
The
internet has really driven these to popularity.
Yes.
I know quite a few of them where you go to a website and it's a fake website for a fake company and you fill out applications, and that is creating your characters, filling out the application.
Yeah, and they've done them also as promotional things for movies, for books, for all kinds of stuff.
The Dark Knight did a few of them too.
Yeah,
Joker.
The last one I came up with was in college. I remember a lot of guys playing games like Mafia, and you'd have somebody at the top, and then he or she would organize everyone into crime syndicates or hitmen and such, and they'd carry around Nerf pistols, and if you shot somebody, they'd be out of the game, and there's all this wheeling and dealing and backstabbing, until finally, by the end of semester, there'd be only one group left standing.
Every time you describe that, I want to go watch the movie Gotcha.
Ugh.
Same concept, only paintball instead. And more 80s. I love the 80s, though, so that's my guilty pleasure.
One thing on recruitment is that I would really suggest that if you've got a local university or college or what have you, if you go and, even if you're not, you know, attending yourself, if you go and look at their society's board, there's a good chance that there is a society that is there. You know, its sole purpose is to facilitate this for the student. Those are a fantastic resource. I mean, it's true that some of them take themselves a little seriously, and you may or may not be able to deal with that, but if you just want to have your in with someone, that's basically what I would suggest to everyone, is to look at colleges and universities, because outside of having friends who are already in it, who can recommend it to you, they're basically the closest thing you've got to, you know, a universal network that can give you those personal recommendations.
Generally speaking, I've drawn most of my players from my theater background. And I've sort of chosen to go along the route where I'm going to run a game, but I'm going to develop contacts with people whom I enjoy spending time with and whose friends I enjoy spending time with. So I sort of prefer to engineer sort of the events from the top down and have complete control over who I'm playing with. And I find that really, it enables me to set a tone and play games that I want to play with complete comfort because of the people, these are the people I personally sought out. And you can't do that with a large scale game, but you can do it if you want to, say, run a game with 15 to 20 people or 30 people. You can go out, find your people that you trust and you enjoy, and just go for it.
So let me open up the floor to you guys. What are some things that you guys, just complete non sequiturs, that you guys would love to say to the gaming world at large? Anything.
Mike, cheers.
All right. Well, first I wanted to give a quick comment about your earlier question about if the Ren Faire actually help for recruitment by asking you this. Does D&D, because most people know what the basic idea of what D&D is, has D&D ever helped you to kind of recruit somebody into gaming?
I would say that's more a question for Dan. I've actually never recruited anyone in. I'm still too new of a recruit myself.
No, honestly, it hasn't. I find there is so much social anathema built up around D&D that I typically have to find some other way to approach the subject.
It's helped me explain what role-playing is, though.
It's the same way for LARPs. It's a good stepping off point for understanding, like, okay, we dress up, we kind of put ourselves in the medieval mindset, but it doesn't really portray what we're doing so much. And that's my stance on it.
I think I'm in a bit of an odd position, and most of the people I know who are into the hobby, I believe, started off in the hobby before they were doing things like D&D. But I couldn't tell you how widespread that is. So I'm not sure that it's a great recruitment tool. I think you're more likely to get them coming from, you know, interest in Vampire.
Look up a major town in your area, LARP or live action combat or medieval combat sport, and just look around and try to judge the flavors. If you're not doing anything for a weekend, it's an interesting experience. I would suggest that everybody try it at least once.
Yeah, I suppose if I could say anything, the thing that I like about role-playing games is that you get to create your own entertainment and you get to learn, particularly if you're building a game, if you're running a game, you do some history research, you sort of look into language, things like that. And with LARP, I think it's got real potential for sort of teaching and learning, if it was ever sort of harnessed in that way, for education, perhaps. It could be a real boon for kids. I mean, kids learn best when they're in motion. And what better way to learn history than to do a little bit of history, just a little slice right there, so you can see why people wore armor or why they speak in certain ways or why historically things might have developed.
That's good. That's good. I agree with it completely, actually. That's my non-sequitur. I guess I'm going to tell people, remember, have fun, because it's not a deadly serious thing. So try and have fun. Try not to spoil other people's fun, unless, of course, that's what you enjoy, I guess. Remember the basic rule, which is rule 7. Don't take the piss.
Where does that rule 7 come from? Because you're not the first person I've heard use that phrase.
Let's see, there's something called the Rules for Better Living, and depending on who you ask, there's a different set of rules. Things like all coke is people's coke and all that sort of thing. It grew up from you know, the UK scene back in, I think, the 80s. So it's things like these very large fest events, like The Gathering and Renewal, which UK listeners would almost certainly be familiar with if they are at all familiar with LRP. Basically, there was one common rule amongst all of these different groups, which was Rule 7, which was don't take the piss. Just try and have fun with, well, I think it's self-explanatory, really. You don't have to, you know, stretch any rules or anything. If you're not going to win, you're not going to win. But try not to be a dick, basically.
We had sort of the basic three tenets was have fun, play safe, don't be a dick.
So even you have it.
No, absolutely. It's universal.
It's just rule 3 over here, apparently.
Yeah.
Honestly, narrow it all down to the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Also, yeah, I'd just like to say, try out a new system. As someone who's running a small one, we're always grateful to get new players trying it out and getting, you know, new ideas. And, you know, you never know. You might really enjoy these new ones. A bit of cross-pollination between the different systems always helps, and don't stick to just one game if you can, because that's the best way to get yourself burned out on anything, really.
I think, too, if you're going to sort of hunt for people try looking in unusual places. Like, to find players in a cosplay situation, you can find them in a just a historical recreation situation. Maybe you've got somebody who, like for me, they do a lot of theater, and this whole idea of creating characters, they've never thought of playing a game like that. They already do it in a lot of ways, but think outside the box, and as Nathaniel said, try something new. Even just try it with a small group of people, and make up your own rules, and just go for it.
Just one more thing.
Sure, go ahead.
People, please, please, don't get so attached to your characters that you can't bear for them to die. I don't want to listen to you whining for hours because I or somebody else stabbed you up. You're not going to hear me whining for hours because somebody stabbed me up.
Well, you know, I guess this kind of goes back to what I was observing earlier about there may be a tendency in LARPing to invest a lot more in your character. I guess, are there games out there where that's off limits? We accept that people are putting so much work into their character and costume that death is an exceptionally rare or off-limits sort
of
thing.
Yeah, some role-playing games, you sit down, you have the rule, okay, we're not going to have player death.
Yeah, unless you act like a total idiot, we're not going to kill your character. I mean, is LARPing the same way?
It shouldn't be, in most cases. It's all circumstance-dependent, because your game may have decided that it wants that particular style or theme, but for the most part, I believe that if no one ever dies, or death is so rare that it's really uncommon, there's no real victory when you survive or you've come out ahead against the odds. You diminish the achievement of success if failure has no real repercussions. And that's true of a combat one. And I'm not generally actually a combat player, despite all that I've said. If there's no risk-reward situation, the reward is pretty lame.
Nathaniel, that brings up a question, which is, what happens when a character dies? Let's say that I'm invested in, it's not a one-shotter like James Runs, but this is an ongoing game, and on a particular weekend, my character dies. What do I do? Do next week I just change costumes and submit a new character and come back, and do we just pass a note around everybody saying, yeah, he's not Bill anymore, he's Fred now? I mean, how does that work?
I would suggest coming prepared with, well, at least the idea of your next character in mind somewhere.
So basically, change of clothes.
Yeah, and a concept, or at least a different personality that you could pull on, even if it's only temporary, to try something on during that event after your character has died.
Is it possible to become an NPC if your character dies, just for the rest of the night?
Some people will go that way. I mean, I've certainly NPC'd because my character has gone and done something which, for whatever reason, they wouldn't be around for the rest of that night. Yeah, I completely agree, because there's some games where I really would not go with a second character, because that's inviting me to get suicidal with my first character, just because I'm someone who actually enjoys the internal exploration of different character concepts and their thought process. I'm perfectly sympathetic to that idea that they don't want to play another character straight away, because they want to sit down and at least try it out in their head for a while. But you've got to be willing to let them go, because ultimately they're not real. Not that important. You're
that's completely opposite from the kind of games that I do, where death is the name of the game, literally, and 5 minutes later you're alive again, up and swinging.
But I assume there's a finite amount of death.
No.
No? Okay.
Your persona is immortal, but you have to die for the battles that you do. You get 15, 16 people on both sides. You can't keep sword fighting forever. That's the main difference between this role-playing and fighting, Tom. That is that if I get hurt certain amount of times, I'm dead, and I'll come back in 5 minutes and do it again.
In other words, it's not so much playing a role-playing game that happens to be live action. You are playing at sword fighting rather than role-playing, which happens to have sword fighting.
Which can have role-playing elements in it, it typically doesn't.
Yeah, so, I mean, in that case, the risk and reward, the reward is victory in the fight in itself, and the risk is that you're not going to win because you are down for the count, so you weren't able to participate and swing things in favor of your side.
Mm-hmm.
It is the same thing, but it's in a different context because it's a different type of game.
James, Michael, Nathaniel, I want to thank all three of you for coming on the show. Give us a chance to talk about this. I appreciate all three of you taking some time out of your evening, or actually in the case of Nathaniel over there in the UK, and taking out some time from your late night and early morning.
It was definitely an educational experience.
Yeah, I hope for people that aren't into LARPing, this is kind of a look back behind the curtain. And for people that are into it, I hope you feel some degree of vindication after 3.5 years of us making jokes about you. And
And there may be more to come.
And by all means, you know, hop on the forums, hop on the blog, let us know what you think.
I'm keep telling
me how wrong I am.
You make jokes, because I agree with a lot of them. So.
This was kind of a test run to see if this sort of thing will work, and if it gets good interest, then we might come back and do it for other topics that really aren't directly within our area of expertise. The big two we're looking at is indie gaming, followed up by one or maybe several in international gaming, looking at gaming in places like East Asia, Europe, even the Middle East. I've had someone from Israel write me and say they'd love to talk about it. So you guys have a great week, have some good games, and we will catch you guys next time.
We're heading to Denny's.
Thank you
very much.
Yeah,
cheers.
Yeah. Bye.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.